Whew. Gotta get back to the game. Gotta get back to the game.
I'm saying, it's been a minute.
It's been a minute, been a minute for your boys.
Dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Greetings and God bless. Welcome to another episode of Pass the Mic, Dynamic Voices for a Diverse Church, powered by The Witness, a Black Christian collective. I'm your host, Tyler Burns. You can follow me on Twitter as long as it's available, and also on Instagram at Burns Clan. Please follow at your own risk. And joining me as always is, man, I don't even know what to call this brother anymore because of what I'm about to tell y'all. But he is, of course, the founder of The Witness. He is the man, the myth, the legend, the two-time best-selling author, Mr. Blue Check Verified himself, Dr. Jamar Tisby. What's going on, brother? You got to tell the people where you at right now as we record this.
Oh, man, I am on a different continent. I'm in the motherland, Doc. I'm in the motherland.
Dog.
I am in Benin, West Africa, in Cotonou. That's where where I be. Yeah, it's an amazing trip, man. I'm here with a group called the Dialogue on Race and Faith. It's a wild story. Hopefully we can do a whole podcast episode on it. A brief preview is that we found, well, somebody in our group found a journal from the 1840s of a white abolitionist who partnered up with a couple of Black Christians to do all kinds of justice work. Some of it took him here to Benin. And so we are here learning about the transatlantic slave trade from the other side of the Atlantic, here for 10 days, and how thoroughly appropriate a setting for what we're going to talk about today.
Man, that's big time, brother. That's major. That's huge. And I can't wait to hear more about that. But listen, we have to apologize to y'all because we know that the audience has been like, these dudes ain't even talked about Black Panther, and these are two Black Pantherist Negroes.
Black Pantherist. I think that's a new one, and I like
it. Hey, man, we trying to blaze new trails out here. Listen, I have to apologize. My family had a situation with one of my family members. I think it's okay for me to even say, but it's my father. He was in the hospital for a little bit, and you know, he's okay and feeling better, but that kind of took all of my energy. So the weekend of Wakanda Forever debuting in theaters, we had to check him into the hospital. So shoot up a prayer for OG, as we call him. Some of you all are familiar with him based upon him being on the podcast. So that kind of took all my attention. And then the Thanksgiving holiday and all kinds of things were going on. Now Jamar's in Africa. So it's been a long time. We shouldn't have left you without a dope beat to step two. Step two, you know the drill.
Wow. That's old school. Hey, man, I'm just going to say we're glad to hear OG is feeling better. Totally understandable about that. Thank you for sharing that. And definitely, I'm still going to be in prayer for you and your family.
No, I appreciate it, man. You've been there asking questions and supporting. So I appreciate you and the Witness team and Bo and everybody just supporting in that regard. But here we are. Of course, y'all already know. And what's funny is both of us saw this movie on opening night.
Which is rare for me.
So we saw this movie, very rare for Jamar.
Usually you and Bo are talking about it for like weeks. But I just happened to be, we happen to be in Louisville, where I'll be moving to as we record this in a couple months. And so—
Oh, hold up. Have we announced this? Has this been officially announced on the pod?
Oh, snap. Oh, no,
pause. Okay, hold up. Okay. Wakanda can wait. Okay, Wakanda gonna be there when we done. We got food at home. But listen, y'all, we got to hold on. We got a big announcement to make because Dr. Jamar Tisby, Wakanda got to wait because Dr. Jamar Tisby just made a life decision and a massive life choice that's going to change his locale, his geography, everything. Tell him, brother, this is major news. This is a drop we haven't made on PTM.
I guess we haven't. It's been public. It's been Facebook official for a while now. But yeah, I'm very, very pleased and honored to accept a position as a professor of history at Simmons College of Kentucky, which is in Louisville. And it is a private faith-based HBCU started in 1879 It's got an incredible story that intersects with the National Baptist Convention, with Ida B. Wells, with all these giants of faith and justice. And I'm honored to be going there, working under Reverend Dr. Kevin Cosby, who's the president and also pastor of St. Stephen Church in Louisville. I've already started actually working remotely. And then my family and I will finally be picking up from the Delta and relocating. So Louisville folks, I would definitely shout you out once I get to the area. I would love to meet y'all. I'm trying to get Tyler, drag him up to Louisville. We do some type of event up there. I don't know, but y'all help me work on it.
Man, you know I'm down, man. Anything for the movement, anything for the fam. Congratulations, brother. We are proud of you, thankful for you, excited to see you in a Black space, ready to see what you're going to produce, all the above, all the feels, all the emotions. Bo, drop some hand claps. I'm just going to trust that Bo's going to drop some hand claps right here. Listen, and this is perfect also to tie into what is a Black space, even if it is Afrofuturistic, and that is Wakanda Forever came out. We both saw it on opening night, as you heard, and we got some thoughts. Now, if you're expecting for us to do something exhaustive, as you can tell, we're not going to go too far in depth. We got a podcast for that. Y'all like, look, man, where's the details? Where's all this? We got a whole podcast for that. It's called Once Upon a Time in Wakanda. And Bo and Aaron did a tremendous job in my absence of holding the fort down and giving you that in-depth, that comic, that you want from us, you know, the perspective.
Oh, they geeked out on it.
Now, for us, we're going to talk about some high-level conversations that people have been having. But first, Jamar, what did you think of Wakanda Forever? What were your initial reactions? And then now, a couple of weeks later, how do you feel about the movie?
First of all, I cried real tears. Like, I was emotional all the way through.
Thug tears to the nth degree.
I'm saying, it took me back to when we found out that we lost Chadwick. It also took me back to the exact moment I saw the first Black Panther in the movie theater, and how I felt there. Just the sense that we have a place we can call home, and it's not broken down or busted up. It's not trying to get up over oppression. It is a place of flourishing, Afrofuturism, as you mentioned. And I remembered that feeling. I remembered that sense as well. But then, you know, that's blended with the utter ache, the real ache of still missing Chadwick, right? So that was, you know, an emotional roller coaster mixed in with, you know, in the front part of my brain kind of evaluating how did they do this? Is this going to be equal to, better than, worse than the first one? How did they handle XYZ? All of that. On top of it, I was there with my son, who doesn't usually like Marvel movies yet. He's still into sort of animated shows and whatnot. So it's a haul, especially with a movie this long, but he really liked it too. So I was just glad we got to share that moment together. And the last thing I'll say is there's a small set of movies that you really need to watch with a Black audience. It ain't every movie. It ain't even every movie with a Black cast, but a movie like Black Panther, the first one or this one, is a movie that I think I would have enjoyed much, much more if it had been a predominantly Black audience, which it wasn't. Because there are certain moments in the film, whether it's moments of surprise, they had a lot of big reveals in the movie, or just sort of like inside Black culture, Black jokes kind of thing, that the audience, had it been predominantly Black, would have responded to audibly, vocally. And it would have made, I think, such a richer experience. As it was, I'm the only one laughing out loud. I'm the only one clapping out loud. It's almost like going to a church that's really like buttoned up and stiff, and you're the one who wants to raise your hand and clap and shout, you might right. still do it, but it sure would be nice if other people right. had that spirit about them too. So those were my overall impressions the first time watching it. How about you?
You know, it's interesting because I really did not know what to expect heading into Wakanda Forever. And I actually think that it's hard to even analyze the movie as a movie and to break it down as a movie. It's almost as though it's doing a disservice to the experience because it's really a meditation on grief. And it's a meditation on the depth of grief of having lost someone who is not just valuable to you, but valuable to your cultural community. And how do we move forward while losing an icon? And so it's really a little bit of a public exercise. And I think that's why it felt so close to home for people, not just because we recognize Chadwick, not just because we like the character he portrayed in Black Panther, but because when we lose icons in our local or national or regional context, or even within our church community, who have meant so much to so many people, how do we reckon with that while still moving forward? So it was very difficult for me to judge the movie walking out of it. But especially with the length of the film, it felt like we went into waves of grief, not just because of Chadwick, but halfway through the film, spoiler, obviously, for this review, halfway through the film, we're having to mourn Queen Ramonda. We're having to mourn the loss of Angela Bassett as well. And that led me to, I think, one of my critiques, which is I would love to experience these characters without tragedy. Would love to experience these characters without Black trauma porn. Like, I would love that. I would love if we didn't have to kill off the entire royal family for there to be a substantive conflict. So that, to me, made it hard to judge the film. But the more I've sat with the film, the more I've enjoyed it. I have not gone to see it a second time, which is shocking. Went to see the first one probably five times in the theater. I'm not going to see it again. Part of it is life and time. My schedule looks totally different now than it did then. And then obviously the situation with my family makes that very difficult. But then secondarily, I think it was very hard for me to make the commitment emotionally again
right,
to the film.
Right, right.
So now I've got to make another commitment to the film. And it wasn't that I didn't want to. It was just that it was hard for me. Secondarily, I think, you know, kind of moving into the second phase of my thoughts, the addition and the adjustment, because most people know this, but Namor is a character who is really Black Panther's chief antagonist in the comics outside of Killmonger. And so the incorporation of Namor in a place like Atlantis is something that was going to come in Black Panther lore. But due to Aquaman and DC, their comic portrayal of Atlantis, for Ryan Coogler to shift it to a Mesoamerican take on Namor
was
absolutely brilliant and daring, and it worked phenomenally well. Mm. And it worked in a way I was not expecting for it to work. And I think beyond that, the broader conversations that it brought up, which we'll touch on here in a second, led to kind of this feeling of, wow, there's something rich to be dealt with in mind here. And this is a Ryan Coogler stan podcast. This is a Ryan Coogler honor space, because what he has done with two films, people still are not getting and grasping the level and degree of difficulty of the concurrent conversations he had in the first Black Panther film, that there are five different inner circle, intra community, in-house conversations that he's having at layers in the first film while wrapping it in a comic book action movie, and then having to deal with losing his main star in real life.
Yeah.
And then turning it and then rewriting the script to being something beautiful. And it is absolutely beautiful. I think when we talk about these supporting characters and these actors who banded together, every single one of them was at the top of their game. Whether that's Okoye, Danai Gurira, whether that's Lupita Nyong'o, whether that's Angela Bassett, Letitia Wright, Winston Duke. They were all phenomenal and they came through. And I felt like there was this sense of communal joy that we got to mine deeper into these characters and we got to build deeper with them. But I kind of want to talk about this from the standpoint of the movie's obviously not without critique or without, you know, things that we could pick apart. But I kind of want to talk about this a little bit differently than we've done reviews before, because I want to talk about three conversations that are rising to the surface, right? And one of them is an obvious conversation. The second one kind of is obvious too. But there's a third one that's kind of emerged as well. So if that's okay, Jamar, I think we should talk about these three conversations really briefly and let that be our take on. That's a very PTM way
of expressing it. Yeah, I like this approach. We got to do the list, and I think we'll cover enough ground there. Again, this is a second conversation about Black Panther, and you can definitely listen to Aaron and Bo if you want even more. But let's get into it. What are the three kind of questions, topics, themes you want?
Yeah, so I think number one would have to be, how does the film handle Chadwick Boseman's departure? And did the film do it justice? There's this funny meme going around that when you realize, you know, that shocked face when you realize none of the Avengers came to Chadwick or to T'Challa's funeral, right? None of them came to T'Challa's funeral while every one of the Avengers was at Tony Stark's funeral, right? And it's kind of this internal Black Twitter joke and all this. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm so glad that the country of Wakanda and the people who lost T'Challa in the film did not have to grieve in front of white eyes.
Ooh.
Wow. I'm really glad. I'm glad that they could have a full meditation and representation of their grief in their way, with their custom and their culture, without feeling as though they had to do that in front of people who don't even really value their culture and can't value their culture in the same way that they do. It's one of these phenomenons, and I feel this way specifically because I do Black funerals. And as a pastor, I do a lot of funerals. And the Black funeral is a little bit different than other types of funerals. I've done other types of funerals where we were the minority, even though we were officiating the funeral. And in that context, the levels of grief, people don't understand that there's wailing, there's screaming, sometimes fighting, there's laughter, there's celebration, there's worship. There's all these things that take place in a 60 to 90 minute moment for the family to put their loved one to rest. And when other people from different cultures come in, it's almost as though they cannot grasp what in the world is going on. They can't grasp what's happening. And it feels awkward to try to mitigate your emotional responses in a moment like that to make them feel more comfortable. No, I'm glad they got to do what they got to do in Wakanda, how they needed to do it, the way they needed to establish it. And sure, it would have been great if we had a delegation and things like that. And I'm sure that would have been a great thing. We know that that's primarily budgetary, right? You get these people in to shoot. They're going to charge you money. I don't care who died. They're going to charge you money, right?
Yeah.
But I personally believe it was really powerful to see them grieve without having to withhold their response or mitigate their response and experience in it how they felt like they needed to. And I felt like that was freeing for us because it didn't feel like, hey, this means something different to our community that we lost to T'Challa/Chadwick Boseman, right? That's how I kind of felt. That was my first initial thought about, you know, them processing his grief.
Yeah, that's the straight up pastor's mind. Like, okay, how are we going to handle the funeral, the bereavement?
Yeah, who got the body, right? Who got the body? Every, yeah, exactly.
You know, that makes sense. That makes sense. I was very curious going into the film how they would deal with the character of T'Challa dying. You know, obviously we know what happened to Chadwick. Well, how do you do that with the Black Panther, right? And so I appreciated that the film dove right in. It wasn't a build up to his death. It wasn't even in the past. You know, that he could have, Ryan Coogler could have just had it as he died and they pick up after that and not even really go into it. So I do appreciate that they tackled it head on, because it would have felt like a gap. It would have felt like something was missing. It would have felt like we didn't quite get the sense of closure, even with the funeral, if we hadn't walked through that part of it. That being said, it felt a little clunky storytelling wise to have T'Challa, you know, not with all of the technology of Wakanda, they couldn't save him. And I get what they did. How they did it was he didn't tell them he was sick. I understand that. And that's literally what Chadwick Boseman did for a lot of folks, except his very inner circle. So one would have thought that as he wrestled with his duties as king and just an individual who's sick, he would have put in place a plan, a succession plan, if for the only reason that I'm not going to be here, what's happening next kind of a thing. Or he would have let an inner circle know. So we see, you know, we see this, the mad scramble to try to find a cure at the last minute, and it's too late. And I'm like, but, you know, in the last film, they had Ross, who had a bullet in his spine or something, transported him all the way.
Yeah, within like 24 hours, he's good.
Yeah, you know, I'm like, it feels like, and even if they couldn't find a cure, it feels like there's something that could have prolonged it. So just from a storytelling perspective, it's like, okay. I mean, I don't know how you do it better, but that felt a little strained to me. Other than that, though, oh man, the way they honored that man.
Yeah.
And I think it could only have been done because I don't even think it was what was said. It was how you knew the actors felt in real life about their friend and their colleague, which just couldn't help but come through the character. So I felt, you know, in terms of how an actor makes an audience feel, I felt how Lupita and Winston and Angela and Letitia may have felt losing someone we've only seen it on screen, but they've been walking with for years in this very intense experience. And I mean, like you said, they were all on their A game. And I can only imagine how much harder it is to be on your A game as a performer, as an actor, when you are truly grieving. And then you have to go through and do this character again. So shout out to all that crew.
Yeah, and I also love that the grieving felt very three-dimensional, right? It felt like there were some people who were dancing and playing drums, others who were weeping, others who were just stoic, you know, in shock. It felt very believable because it is believable, right? It's what they're really having to navigate as they're filming this. But your comment about the technology element is fascinating because there's a couple of arguments here, right? So the argument is they could have had a movie, Wakanda Forever, could have been set during the snap. So it could have been set during the moments where, you know, T'Challa had wasted away but was coming back, right? So it could have been set during the snap, or it could have been set in a different timeline with the multiversal elements. It could have been set differently. And that would have mitigated this idea that Wakanda somehow in this one place, when it's most necessary for them to be a technological giant and geniuses, they can't come through. But right. I love that because it showed the permission for, I love that it was honest enough to say, while the Wakandans are brilliant and intellectual and in many ways superheroes, they're not gods and they're not magicians. So people will die and people will fail and people will make mistakes. And just like T'Challa did in the first film, people will make political miscalculations and they'll do things that are unwise. And that's just part of the nature of who they are and the nature of their humanity. And so I liked seeing not liked in terms of enjoyed, but it was so palpable, that opening scene. The scene of Angela Bassett coming in and saying he's gone, he's with the ancestors. Yeah. The scene, which I love that language, right?
Yes.
Because that's really how we feel about Chadwick. The scene of the frantic nature of Shuri looking around, trying every DNA match that she can, again and again and again and again. And I appreciated seeing that humanity because it made me believe that these characters are accessible, that they're not gods, you know, that they don't have superpowers outside of what they technologically advanced to. They're real, and it felt real. And it felt like those moments for those of us who have lost people who are close to us of frantic disturbance. And what can we do, and how quickly can we get them to help and to the hospital and to these things? And so I think that's a good critique. Yes, it feels a little hollow. Why, what, if the place that's the most technologically advanced can't save their own king? But isn't that kind of how it is often?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of how it is sometimes. Mean,
obviously, they couldn't have foreseen what happened to Chadwick Boseman in real life. So they couldn't have, quote unquote, set it up, right? But if you think about every other, quote unquote, defeat that the Wakandans faced, it was like all off campus. When T'Chaka killed his brother, that's in California. Even when Killmonger is killed, it's by an equal, you know?
Right.
It's not a failure of technology. Even in the battle in Avengers Endgame or Infinity Wars, they still have the shield, and the only way they were defeated is when half the universe's population is defeated. You know, it wasn't like a failure of Wakanda. So anyway, there was no indication prior to that. Oh, and when T'Chaka was killed, right? That's off campus too. So there was no indication that within the kingdom, something like this would happen.
Wow.
So that's all. Again, it was impossible to set up because they didn't know what was coming. But then when it came, I was like, and then this could be seen either as full circle or a disruption, because Shuri was able to synthesize the purple flower later.
Right.
So she was able to use the technology to regain the source of the Black Panther's power in that manner, which you could see as, oh, well, she couldn't save the king before through her technology, but now she's coming through and she's restoring the throne in a way. Or you could say, well, if she could synthesize the purple flower later, you know, why couldn't she do something about this? So anyway,
that makes total sense. I completely understand. Yeah. And that's a very controversial element. And then the other controversial element that I think, you know, people had in addition to that, which I guess leads us to the second part of this conversation, which is, you know, Chadwick Boseman not being recast, you know, by the studio, and Shuri taking on the mantle, which was the obvious choice. Obviously, if you listen to us, we've talked about this and on the Wakanda podcast and how Shuri is Black Panther in the comics. And there's actually a moment in time in one of the more recent runs where both T'Challa and Shuri have the power of the Black Panther, because the Panther God Bast bestows power to T'Challa, even though Shuri takes on the mantle while he is sick and while he is injured, right? And so it's kind of a strange foreshadowing even. But, you know, there was this big conversation, and I felt like initially that Kevin Feige's announcement, the person who executive produces all the Marvel movies, his announcement that was kind of very final, which was, we have no plans to recast T'Challa. You know, that felt very disheartening to me, because I said, I really believe that every child, every Black child should be able to see a character and enjoy a character like T'Challa, that this is something that means so much to our community. And so I was part of the initial, we should recast T'Challa, especially if you give the movie time. So I expected that they would push the movie back. So if you push the movie back, then you can give time. You can give time and space and do tributes and all that, but don't rob everyone of the character. Now, having seen the film and also with the timeline that they have, it wouldn't have made any sense within this film to recast T'Challa. Now, there were some other options. You could have done the multiverse option, which is actually something they still may do, right? So you incorporate another alt version of T'Challa, who's a famous actor, who can step in and take on that mantle. You know, a lot of people are saying Jonathan Majors or Damson Idris or, you know, whoever it may be. Obviously, he can't be Kang and T'Challa, but still, you know, people are saying, you know, oh, it could be Michael B. Jordan because Killmonger is Black Panther at one point. All the above, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think for this particular film, it was wise of them not to recast T'Challa because it doesn't take future options off the board, but it does give us space to grieve. And I think as an audience, it would have been too jarring and too overwhelming to just shift and hit that switch button really quickly and say, well, you know, here he is. I think that would have been overwhelming for us as an audience.
I mean, just going back a bit, that was one of the moments when Shuri was revealed as the next Black Panther, where I wished I was in the theater with a Black audience because we would have gone bonkers.
Oh yeah, for sure.
To see that, it was a very powerful scene. But yeah, I appreciate that. I don't think so. It was handled well overall, in my view, that they did not just do a one-to-one recast of T'Challa. They had a Black Panther successor, which is good. Now we still get, you know, the little kids growing up with a, you know, Black Panther character. But we have to acknowledge this Black Panther, the first one, and now the franchise, it's so much more than a film. It's so much more than a film. It is a cultural touch point, particularly and especially for Black people, in such a way that it is not a franchise you leverage. It is a gift that you steward.
Oh, that's good, Doc. Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. This can't just be about the next blockbuster hit. This is about stewarding a treasure of stories. And it is about almost shepherding people. It was a very pastoral decision, I think, not to recast T'Challa right away. Because you're right, we need that time to grieve, and we need that. It's a process, and it's not linear, and it's not like, you know, time is ever going to erase all of this. But to do it right now would have just been, like you said, too jarring. So I do applaud them for that. And I think, given the absolute worst case scenario, it wasn't an injury, it wasn't a contract dispute, it wasn't even a supporting character. You lost your main character, a transcendent star who even at a young age had already racked up a legendary acting career.
Absolutely.
And you lost him suddenly. How on earth? So the fact that they even were able to pull together and make this film at all, and then let alone do it well and help us grieve, golly.
Ryan Coogler is a wizard. Like, I mean, he's a wizard. And I mean, the film is still tremendous in terms of its score and soundtrack, still tremendous in terms of costumes and set design, still tremendous, right? I think that the hard part at the end was knowing that they didn't just lose Chadwick as a force within the film, but they lost Angela Bassett as well.
Come on, talk.
And the gravity of that loss, which, again, listen, if Angela Bassett is not nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, The Witness is starting a petition. The Witness will be starting a petition if that does not happen, because she was phenomenal. It's like she rose to the occasion in a way that only she could have. And now losing the gravity of both of those characters feels very overwhelming about the future of the franchise. And one of the things I wish that maybe could have been done is maybe some more stabilization within the franchise. So, you know, you had at the end, M'Baku, you know, stands up and says he wants to, challenge for the throne, right? Which he presumably will win because they didn't show it, right? So he presumably will be on the throne, which is a very big decision, especially for him because of the different religions within Wakanda even. That's very fascinating and to see how they'll navigate that. But I think also, I would really just love to see more stabilization within the gravity of the franchise to say, we need some elder statesmen and elder stateswomen who are going to really provide the foundational depth and the gravitas that's necessary. Because as much as I enjoy Letitia Wright's acting, I felt like her turn as Black Panther felt like something was missing so far. And I want to give her space and room to grow into the role. And right. also candidly, perhaps the fact that in real life she's anti-vax and like, maybe that's clouding my judgment, right?
That was
maybe
a little that's bit clouding in the back of my mind too. Yes.
Yeah. You know, the chief scientist in the MCU is anti-vax. That feels weird. Mm-hmm. But you know, so maybe that's clouding my judgment, and maybe that's, but she did an admirable job with what she had. I just feel like she needs to grow into the role more. Mm-hmm, and I even feel like her turn at the end felt rushed.
Right.
Like, you know, when all of a sudden we don't see Ramonda in the ancestral plane. And then all of a sudden she's like, oh, you know, hey, show them who you are. It's like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, where did that come from? You know what I'm saying? Like, dope. But like also, man, that probably should have been earned a little bit more. And I feel like Coogler need some time to figure out how to write for Letitia in that role.
Oh, that's
and how to write her into that growth and into that gravitas. But it kind of leads us to another element, which is, oh, you know, people, I'm hearing from the streets are saying men, Black men got erased. Streets are saying Black, streets saying what, ain't no Black men in Wakanda.
What street they on?
I didn't say which street. I was just saying streets are saying. It wasn't MLK Boulevard, I'll tell you that. I'm just saying streets are saying. What you think about that? You know, Black men getting erased, Jay?
That is not how I felt walking out of that movie. Like I said before, I watched it with my son. He's 12. And I was very glad that he saw a women-led, women-centered, Black women-centered film. And it was just what it was. It wasn't some big deal. It was a big deal because we know about the historical and contemporary attempts at erasure of Black women. But the fact that you had this cadre of women, I mean, there was Ironheart was new. She was inserted in there, and some of the other warriors stepped up. But really, they were all the elements were there. All the people were there. So it's not like they had to rush and scramble and add new characters and actors. And it actually, I thought there was continuity with the first film because when they thought T'Challa had been killed, when Killmonger threw him off the waterfall, who stepped up? It was Queen Ramonda, it was Shuri, it was all of the women, right? And so why would this be any different? And it reminded me, I mean, I was surprised even when we talked about this before that folks were taking that tack. And it reminded me of that quote, when you're used to privilege, equality feels like oppression. And I'm not saying the guys on this street are saying they feel oppressed, but the fact that you would kind of raise a stink about it means it just goes to show how used to we are as men, especially in Marvel movies, right? We're used to the Avengers having that the token woman or the Guardians of the Galaxy, the token woman, right? It shows how used to we as men are of being the hero, being the main character, driving the story, and not simply as background characters. All that said, I would say I was disappointed not to see Winston Duke play a more prominent role. He had been set up for that in the first film. He was a breakout star. I think he could have done it. But that was, I wouldn't have wanted him to do more than he did at the expense of the women who really did drive the story and did so well.
Hey,
everybody. This is Tyler.
This is Dr. Jamar Tisby.
And we are excited that you're listening to this episode of Pass the Mic. But let me encourage you to support us. You can do so by going to patreon.com/passthemic. And for just $1 an episode.
Just a dollar?
Now, that's the bare minimum. That's four quarters. But if you want to go higher, okay, 5, 10, higher. 15, that's 20, right. 25, whatever it is, that will keep this show going and keep the high quality that hopefully you enjoy. So thank you for listening, but you can take it to the next level.
Patreon.com/passthemic. We appreciate you.
You know, I think that's really well said, Jay. I think the idea of introducing another guy or random guys in this would have felt very odd and would have been, I think, unfair to them in the specter of us being honest about the fact that, as you said, the women did step up in the first film. These are characters who knew him. These are characters who loved him. These are characters who have a relationship with him. These are characters who we got to know. And so I personally feel like it would have been ridiculous. And I actually think that the idea that there aren't men in Wakanda, especially considering the councilmen who are there in terms of the High Council, I think that's just absolutely ridiculous. Now, here's what I will say. In the first film, I think what people are referencing, the charitable kind, not the people who are trying to be like, oh, it's an agenda to replace men, but charitably, the people who are actually thinking about story balance, I would say, okay, you're missing T'Challa, Killmonger for most of the film, T'Chaka, Njidoku, Wakabi. Okay, now you are missing like five very prominent male characters from the first film who were important in various ways and various levels, but they're pretty important, right? So from a story balance perspective, sure, you're missing a couple of perspectives that probably you should incorporate. But I think giving the women that space and that room was not wrong, didn't feel deficient, didn't feel like a tokenizing move at all. It felt like that's the next iteration of these characters. That's the next iteration of who they are and their growth, right? If you take something like in Avengers Endgame, when all the women kind of had that, you know, power up moment.
And yeah, they would, yeah.
You know, initially I was like, man, I ain't going to die on that hill. That ain't that big of a deal. But if you look back on it now, you're like, ah, okay, that kind of feels very like, that feels a little bit tokeny. You know, that feels like,
yeah.
That takes me out of the film, right? It's fine, but it takes me out of the film, right? Because I'm like, okay, maybe they all did this. And it's plausible that they could, but the chances of that aren't really high in a battle for Earth's future. So I'm just saying, it doesn't really feel like ladies, that's something
ladies,
they
ladies,
do.
Come on, everybody, yeah, come to the like, spot on the battlefield. I don't care who's trying to kill you or the person next to you. Come on, we gotta get the picture. Let's go.
Everybody stopped fighting at that moment, like to come over. It's like it doesn't make a lot of sense, right? But you know, now looking back on that, that looks a little like, okay, let's not do that. But this doesn't feel like that at all. This feels like
not at all.
These are the best people to take over. And if any one of them became Black Panther, I'd be like, of course. It makes all the sense
exactly.
in the world.
Exactly. Well, it because I had listened to you and Bo, I was expecting Shuri to take on the mantle. And of course that follows the comic books. But I was like, it could be Nakia. Like it would that
I would have loved
that. Outlandish. I wouldn't have been it would have been a little odd, but it wouldn't have been completely out of her character for even Queen Ramonda, you know, or
right.
somebody.
Exactly. Just for a moment. And that's actually what I thought was going to happen. I thought they were going to find some sort of technology that was going to make it almost like people vying for that particular technology so that different people would have to wear it to keep it away from certain people, that it wouldn't be an herb anymore, but that it would be, you know, an article of clothing is something that attaches to your DNA for a set period of time or whatever it may be, right? Or to your nervous system or what have you. And so I thought that it was going to jump between different people, right? And I kind of feel that I'm glad they didn't do that because, again, it's not about that. Nakia doesn't need to be Black Panther to be influential. Okoye doesn't need it. Queen Ramonda does. They know they know their space. They know where they're called to be. They know their purpose. And I think even questioning that in the moment when Okoye had to basically put down being the leader of the Dora Milaje, like that's huge, right? Wow. So when she had to put that down, that's like, oh, she can still influence. She can still be powerful. She can still be a person who protects Wakanda, even if she doesn't have that title. It just shifts, right?
And it just gives us an opportunity through this storytelling to have actual complex Black female characters in a superhero movie, right? Let's not forget the genre here. It is an absolutely male-dominated genre to the point where you hardly get any sort of complex, multi-layered character development of women because there are so few and because they so seldom take a central role. So would we have had that scene where in the throne room, when Angela Bassett gives her Oscar moment, you've lost something. Let me tell you what I've lost. And just slays that moment. You don't have space for that in a story unless women are central. And again, because it was done so well, the first film, it didn't feel tokenized in the second, to your point. So for me, I felt my evaluation is that it was done well because it wasn't a thing when I walked out of the theater.
Right.
It wasn't something that was high on my mind. If it did come up, I was excited and glad and thinking about the moment of cinematic history that just happened with this primarily Black women led Marvel superhero movie.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that kind of leads me to kind of wrapping up here. I think the thing that missed for me, the more I think about it, it didn't bother me as much as I left, but the thing that missed for me is Ironheart. And not because I don't like the character or the actress. I felt like there wasn't enough time to really build that up to be what it should be.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And I felt like that was the one thing that I felt like missed. And I felt like, I'm struggling here. Now I get the impetus for it and it makes sense. It just wasn't as believable in that moment. And I feel like Ironheart deserved maybe a different type of introduction and an introduction that I feel like could have been even more special for that particular character. Now, maybe all of this is kind of leading us to our third and final area, which is, again, streets talking, Jay, streets talking. And streets telling me a couple of things. Streets telling me Namor not a villain. And the streets telling me that Namor's Talokan and Wakanda should not have been fighting each other. They should have been working together to fight the oppressors. That's what I'm hearing. Streets telling me that.
Which street is it? Think is about this the same street? Is this the
no,
same
it's a different street.
Okay,
it's definitely a different street.
Street.
Come on,
okay,
man. It's a definitely a different street.
Just want to know.
I had to walk a couple of blocks. I had to walk a couple of blocks. I'm good on any blocks.
I just got to tell where the Uber driver to go. Okay. So, first of all, just to sort of segue from your last point, I agree about Ironheart. And to think about, we could have a conversation this long before we even got to Namor and that whole dynamic. It just tells you there was a lot going on. And quite honestly, I don't know if the story would have suffered much if we didn't have the Ironheart storyline in it. You know, I don't know.
It could have been anybody, you know, it could have been a lot of different people.
It could have been more on the Ross story, which was really interesting. And fun way they
nah,
did
get,
that.
Get him out of here. Get him out of here. We don't need to set up Thunderbolts. Get him out of here. Get him out of here.
It could have been anybody. And I don't know how, you know, anyway. But to your next point, you know, Black on brown violence.
Okay. Okay. So we doing this. Okay.
But I'm not.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of conversations to be had in the real world about inter-ethnic solidarity between Black and Latino folks, between Latino folks and Asian folks, between now Black people and Jewish people, apparently is a thing. Thanks Kanye, but that's another topic.
And Kyrie.
So even in the real world, we have so much drama and confusion between people of color. I don't think there's really a sort of predominant narrative about relationships between Black people and brown people, because it's very complex. You have a national story. You have like a large Cuban population in Florida. You have a large Puerto Rican population in New York. You have a large Mexican population in Southern California and the Southwest. And then you also have the international story of Central and South America and the dozens of countries that make up those, right? And then you've got African descended people who are also Spanish speaking, right? So there's all these dynamics. There's not even, I don't think, really a predominant narrative in the real world about our relationships between people, different peoples of color. So then when you put it in a story like Wakanda Forever, there's a lot people are working through. So what we have to do is we have to get transported back to an Aztec culture, which, as people who are not from that culture or haven't studied it, there's a lot to learn and a lot to take in just from that sort of the Aztec elements of the culture that Kugler brought in. But then you have to think about the sort of macro level of the story of these two kingdoms fighting one another. So I'm not of the opinion that they shouldn't have set it up that way, that the conflict can't be between two kingdoms of color. I'm just saying that it is a lot of sort of mental putting of puzzle pieces together to sort of analyze and watch and view and try to enjoy, but also understand that story on so many different levels. When honestly, we have, at least me as a Black person, has a lot more work to do to even understand those dynamics well.
Yeah, I often take from one of my mentors, she's not a doctor quite yet, but she will be, Dr. Sandra Van Opstel, who talks about collective flourishing, right? And when Sandra talks about collective flourishing, like, I think it's really powerful that we think about communities of color working together. And I think that's powerful to think about the fact that in many cases, you take your major cities, we would be majority if we were on the same side on issues and able to, even if we're not on the same side on every issue, we're actually able to organize together and work together on common causes. Now, in this case, Namor a villain. Now, listen, I know everybody's going to try to make this like, he's an antagonist. And Ryan Coogler even said, well, he's an antagonist. And okay, now, when Namor starts stealing wives, okay, because that's coming. When your boy starts stealing wives, when he start, killing people out of nowhere, when that starts happening in future movies, don't come back around and be like, well, he complicated and everything. Buddy is, don't do that. It ain't gonna be no more room.
Oh, but he cute though.
look, that's between y'all and God. Work out your own salvation. I ain't talking about how Buddy look. I ain't talking about none of that. I'm saying if we go in by what we know, he's a villain in this context. Now, sure, there is gray in him and there are understandable elements, but I especially want us to be very careful about how it seems like in two movies. It seems like we are making it more and more comfortable for violence against Black women or the threat of violence against Black women to lead to a, well, he complicated. Mm. That's not complication. That's toxicity. That's not complication. That's iniquity. Stop calling that complication. Because when you threaten to kill a Black scientist who is a young woman, and when you in Killmonger's case, when you choke a Black working class woman and lift her above your head. And when you kill your girlfriend in order to protect your cover, don't tell me about complicated. Mm. These characters are wrestling with complicated and complex ideologies. They themselves had actions that were not complicated at all. Okay, this anti-black. Okay, this is misogynistic. Let's call it what it is. So I'm very careful about this because we have to be really. We are setting a tone here, I believe, where every time someone threatens violence against women, now we're saying, well, you know, because nobody thinks Claw is complicated. Like nobody from the first film, nobody's like, you know, Ulysses Claw, he kind of had a point. Nobody's saying that because he don't talk in dope sentences. He don't put his words together. He don't have some compelling, and he not cute. So we need to be careful here. And so I was very aghast at some of the conversations I'm hearing. I'm like, now, hold on now. I understand he has trauma and that affects him. And I'm not saying there's not a history and a backstory for Killmonger and for Namor. But I'm saying we need to be careful about, well, he ain't a villain. If you threatening to kill,
well,
come on now. If you just show up in Wakanda and you like, listen, you do this or else. And they're like, hold on, who is you?
It's throwing like,
we don't
tomatoes.
Know who you are. You're going to show up to the queen while the queen's trying to grieve her son and then be like, well, you know what? If you don't do this, it's about to be on. And everybody's
man,
like,
you better go eat a starfish.
Right, exactly. But, exactly.
In defense of good writing, though, I'll say what Coogler and the writers have done in both films is move beyond a very two-dimensional villain who's easy to hate. You know, you even got glimmers of this
course.
with Thanos, right? Right. But then when we saw Killmonger, that took it to a whole other level because folks
who also killed a black woman. Who also killed a black woman, by the way. Gamora. Yes. Here we go.
And black woman.
Gamora's black.
She was green in the film. But anyway. But at least I think what they're trying to do with the also inevitable consequence of having black women in prominent roles is they're also putting in harm's way. But I think what they're trying to do, and I think what they've largely succeeded at in the films, is create a character who is an antagonist, who, yes, I think we could safely say is a villain, but who you're also like, well, they might have a point. Or what would, at the very least, you're saying, I wonder what I would do in that situation, which I think is great writing. Makes it more interesting. For sure.
Oh, absolutely. Now, this is not that standpoint. This is not from the standpoint of saying, oh, there isn't complexity in the ideological realities that are at play and the locational, you know, historical reality of where they came from, what they're going to do. All I'm saying is we just need to be very careful as a culture because it seems like we're being desensitized to violence against Black women. And I say this at a time where, as we record this, if I'm not mistaken, Tory Lanez trial is happening, right? Mm-hmm. And this is an artist mm-hmm. who shot Meg Thee Stallion, you know, a fellow artist who is extremely popular, of course. And so again, now these are lines, you know, in double entendres and rap songs and people saying, ah, well, you know, she lying and all this and she made it up. And, you know, Tory's a great artist. And, you know, I'm just hearing a lot of these things. And so perhaps this is hypersensitivity to say, hey, we need to be careful about, you know, being desensitized to the idea that Black women can experience great harm from characters who we respect and admire for different reasons. And we justify that harm because we respect or admire these characters. And we think, oh, they should be a good guy, or they should be this, or they should be that, or they bring something to the table that's different. I think from Ryan Coogler's perspective, he's writing this to say, okay, how did these countries get together, right? Which is where they end up, right? How do they get to a place of understanding? And do they have to go through violence and bloodshed? Probably not, but it's reality that they probably would. But based upon Wakanda's exceptional action And based upon Wakanda's decision to forgive and Wakanda's decision to, you know, frankly, turn the other cheek, they're able to work together and move forward, right?
When they go
That's
look.
Really what we see, right? Oh, you killed my mom, but hey, man. I ain't gonna let vengeance consume me, just like T'Challa didn't let vengeance consume him in Civil War. So I'm not gonna do this, and just like my brother didn't do it then, so let's work together and let's fight together in the future. And I think that's cool. I'm just saying, y'all don't act brand new when Namor gets written differently by a different writer, because that's Namor. Okay, don't act brand new. Don't come back around and be like, well, y'all didn't say this was going. I told y'all it was gonna happen. So when it happens, don't be like, ah, man, I can't believe that they ruined the character. No, that is the character. He is who he thought he is. Okay, I'm just saying. I'm trying to prepare y'all for some heartache and some heartbreak.
Yeah, and you're also telling us that you're basically a Will Smith fan, and you want more black men stepping up and slapping people in defense of black women.
So this
right?
would be perfect, right? This would be perfect because people got mad at me for how I talked about Will Smith before, and people called me out about it. And I said, man, maybe I was too harsh. And now y'all going to say you a Will Smith apologist. So this will be full circle. I'm here for it all. Get you somebody who can do both. Get you a podcast host who can do both. No, I think there is a great, I really appreciate the conversation, though. And I appreciate the conversation, especially as it relates to the people of Talokan, who I treat a lot differently than Namor. Right. Mm. So the people of Talokan are different in because they're following a leader who's been around for hundreds of years. Right. And that leader, having been around for hundreds of years, has some set ideals. And yes, he is trying to protect, but he's also telling them what to do. Right. So they're following his lead, and he knows more about the surface world than they do. Right. And so he understands a little bit more. He's the one making the threat. It's not a thousand of his people there with him, right? Mm-hmm. He's the one making the threat. He's the one who's saying, okay, somebody was killed, you know, on our territory, so now we have to go and avenge, right? He's the one that's influencing all of that. So it's not to say, again, that it's necessarily all malicious of what Namor is doing, but I sense a lot of cunning and guile in him. A lot of cunning and guile.
Yeah.
A lot of it, right? And so I'm saying, okay, well, yeah, I'm not going to give a character who's that clever all the benefit of the doubt. Even if I didn't know anything about the comics or a character, I'm not going to give that character all the benefit of the doubt. Like, he doesn't know. He has plausible deniability. I don't think Namor does. He's been around more than anybody else in the film. I think he knows what's up, and I think he knows what he was doing when he approached in that way. So that's what I would say to kind of close that loop. But go ahead.
Well, he all but tips his hand at the end, where he's talking to his one of his lieutenants, who's basically like, "Yeah, we're going to make them think we're their allies, and then when it's necessary or convenient, we'll be where we need to be. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer."
Right. So absolutely.
Yeah. He definitely intimated all of that. I definitely respected. It was really incredible the way that they were able to build this underwater world within a film that on the surface, the
brilliant, brilliant. Surface,
there was so much going on just in Wakanda. But then, my goodness, not only did he build a world, he took that bold step of saying this is going to be an Aztec world. And here's all of the sort of cultural trappings that most of the viewers probably aren't that familiar with, but we're going to weave it in a way that feels as authentic as you can be in a underwater world, right?
Yes.
So you walked away with a sense, oh, there really is this whole other nation. And then back to your point about, you know, black on brown violence, or what does it mean that they were pitted against each other instead of against the oppressor, which would be, you know, European descended people or white people. It's almost like they're the only two heavyweights. They're the only two world superpowers in that sense, right? Because they set it up at the beginning of the movie that no other country could come close to Wakanda. So when the queen sets up this dramatic showdown in like the UN or wherever they were, and marches in the actual soldiers who were sent in undercover to do dirt. And it's like, oh, we caught y'all. Matter of fact, we got the proof. Here they are. Bring them in. Bring them in. Okay, so next time y'all want to say something to us, just don't. So like, how in that world would Wakanda and Namor's kingdom, who could, if they teamed up, there would be no one who could.
Right, that is true. Yeah.
A fair fight, right? Like, so if they can go against every major nation in the world and still come out sparkling. So in a way, they were the only two who could go up. They were the only two heavyweights, right?
Yeah.
And so in a sense,
yeah, everybody else is below their weight class. Yeah.
Oh yeah. You're not gonna punch that.
That we know. There's a couple of countries that still have yet to be revealed that I think probably still could give them a go. But yeah, that's kind of future talk. And I think also Namor, he acknowledges that. He's like, man, Black Panther, you know, is the most powerful, you know, she's the most powerful you know, character, most powerful fighter and leader on the most powerful nation in the world, right? So he even acknowledges after Trey says, all right, they better. Like, cool, you know, you got me. You know, but we gonna be right here. And so I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely. Well, Jay, this has been awesome. There's so much more that we can cover. I'm sure that we may even be talking about this in a couple of weeks. Potentially with our cultural artifacts episodes, maybe, who knows, might make a reemergence. They might literally be back. But thank you so much for hanging with us, rocking with us, everybody. I want to hear your thoughts. What did you think about Wakanda Forever? Where we bugging? Is Namor the truth? And I just don't see it. You know, what they call him, Aqua Poppy? Is he just Aqua Poppy? And I'm just blind to it.
I've got to go with you on some of your trips to the streets, because you be hearing some things that are hilarious.
Hey, man, streets is watching, man. I don't know what to tell you. Streets is watching, man. But thank y'all so much for tuning in. Jay on the motherland, thank you for rocking with us, man. A full 9 hours ahead, 8 hours ahead, whatever it is, man. Thank you for rocking with us, brother. We appreciate you, and we appreciate you as an audience. Let us know what you think, and we'll see you soon on the next Pass the Mic. We never do it on time. We never do it in the same place.
It's all right.